are the words Moses spoke to all Israel in the desert east of the Jordan, that is, in the Arava opposite Suf between Paran and Tophel, Laban, Hazeroth, and Dizahab. It takes 11 days to go from Horeb to Kadesh Barnea by the Mount Seir road. In the 40th year, on the first day of the 11th month, Moses proclaimed to the Israelites all that the Lord had commanded him concerning them. This was after he had defeated Sihon, king of the Amorites, who reigned in the Heshbon, and at Edrei had defeated Og, king of Bashan, who reigned in Ashtaroth. East of the Jordan in the territory of Moab, Moses began to expound this law, saying, "The Lord our God said to us at Horeb, 'You have stayed long enough at this mountain. Break camp and advance into the hill country of the Amorites. Go to all the neighboring peoples in the Araba, in the mountains, in the western foothills, in the Negev, and along the coast, to the land of the Canaanites, and to Lebanon, as far as the great river, the Euphrates. See, I have given you this land. Go in and take possession of the land that the Lord swore he would give to your fathers, to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and to their descendants after them.'" The word of the Lord.
Dear Village Church and visitors, what you really need is a sense of belonging. You need to belong. You need to belong to a group of something, of some people, somewhere. And you could find something like it in a bar where everyone knows your name, or a family where you all have the same name, or other social institutions, or your job. But they don't really fill up that need. They go only so far. They don't really fill up that need for belonging that you have, do they? Besides, family members die. You get fired. Organizations fold. And it feels terrible because that longing to belong flares up during those times. Especially in New York City. I know you need a sense of belonging, because the city will isolate you. I was reading recently E.B. White's work, Here's New York. E.B. White, whose prose I really appreciate, and he wrote this. This is 1949. "I heard the Queen Mary blow one midnight, though, and the sound carried the whole history of departure and longing and loss." Interestingly, I came across a very similar passage bringing up a very similar image in Albert Camus' writings, kind of his diaries, when he was in New York. This is just 3 years earlier, 1946. Camus writes, "Manhattan. Sometimes from beyond the skyscrapers, across the hundreds of thousands of high walls, the cry of a tugboat finds you in your insomnia in the middle of the night. And you remember that this desert of iron and cement is an island." Bright words this morning from Camus about our city. Well, Christianity claims that there's a way to fill up that need for belonging. But it comes in a different way than you'd expect. It comes from you connecting yourself to an ancient story. And you don't fill up that need that you have until you enter into the covenants that God has made with people. That's why he's made them, folks. Because God knows that you need to belong. So, you need to look at where God makes these covenants. So what we're doing today is turning and beginning to take a tour through a book where God's covenant is made with people. And this church, which is on a quest for an identity, I think, must find its belonging in the same way. So if we look in the Bible for where it is that God makes a covenant, and a covenant that's very similar, I think, in terms of the circumstances to where we are as a church, it's in the book of Deuteronomy. Now, as soon as I say that, I know some of you might begin to feel this already, and I want to warn you if you don't. If we go in and say, okay, we're going to try to learn from the book of Deuteronomy where God is making a covenant, actually a covenant renewal. If we do that in this season, the first thing that we're going to hit is the enormous cultural distance between the publishing of this document and ourselves. I mean, all this seems very remote. None of you that I know of live in Israel right now. It's very far away, the place. Some of you, probably most of you, not very familiar with its geography. And Moses lived in, I don't know, 15th, 14th, looking these days like the 13th century B.C., some 3,300 years ago. These events might seem impossibly remote to you. And that's good. You know, that's good if you realize that, if you feel that remoteness. If you're respecting the cultural distance there, because it's there. You can see this any place you read in the Old Testament. You open up, I was reading a place recently as a good example of this, Judges 14. It's reading in Judges 14. It says, a lion attacked, and Samuel picked up the lion, and he tore it like he would tear a young goat. Now, you can tell, by the way, it's written, that the original audience is supposed to read that and say, wow-wee, he tore that lion like it was a young goat? Boy, I was just doing that this morning. It was so easy, tearing this goat. He must be really strong, Samson. You know. So I don't know about you, but I haven't torn a young goat recently. And, you know, I hope you can respect me after I confess this, but I've never torn a young goat. So, you know, I gather that tearing a lion with your bare hands is a hard thing to do. I can see that, you know, but I can't correlate it with anything in my experience. Except maybe in terms of difficulty, you know, trying to get a wardrobe through my Greenwich Village apartment into the bedroom. You know, that's kind of like tearing a lion. Trying to get the phone company to turn on my phone, that it makes me feel like I want to tear a lion. That's difficult. But the cultural distance is there. And many times, you know, I think as Christians, we haven't respected the cultural distance. And consequently, try to read meaning from our lives from the Old Testament. And the Jews look at what we're doing, and it's just hilarious to them. And many times, our exegesis is the laughingstock of Jews because, and rightfully so, because we're getting in there without even respecting the historical context, trying to get the meaning out of it for our lives. So we become a laughingstock that way. But if we respect it, you know, there's another danger, and that is you respect it so much you think it's inaccessible to you. That distance that's there, I want to try to bring out for you today, it doesn't mean that there's no meaning for us. On the contrary, folks, it is through navigating that distance that we come to have a sense of how we belong. Because it is in navigating that distance that we connect with the longest-running social program on earth, the bringing of God's kingdom. Here, there, in our hearts, in our locations, in our places. So you need to traverse that distance to truly see how you belong to God, how you belong to the people of God. And that's why we should support scholarship. Because we believe that God has worked in history and spoken in history, and so his truth must be understood through understanding the original context. The original languages, the original culture, discerned through history and archaeology and related disciplines. These are crucial for understanding the scriptures because the Bible is not the Quran and it's not the Vedas. It's not a book of a timeless truths that doesn't matter what they're connected to, when they occurred. It's all shrouded in mist anyway. That's not the Bible. It's a story of the truth. Actually, the truth is a story according to the scriptures. And if, you know, I have to bring this out. You've got to see that. It's got to be that way. Because if you don't see that God was working in the lives of actual people like you, then why on earth, how on earth could I convince you that God would work in your lives today? So you can see it in these opening verses. In verse 1, see, these are Moses' words spoken east of the Jordan. It's very important to setting authorship and location here. And the title of the Hebrew book, that actually these books of the Torah don't really have titles. So the title comes from the first few words. And you see that with the other books as well. Genesis, in the beginning, right? That title comes from the first few words of the book. Vayikra, and he called, is really the Hebrew title of Leviticus. And you know, as it turns out, these first few words turn to be great, poignant synopses of the books. And the Hebrew title for Deuteronomy is Ela Ha Tbarim. These are the words. These are the words. These are the words of Moses spoken east of the Jordan. So it's crucial, you see, the history is being set here. These are a series of addresses being given. And the date in verse 3, the first day of the 11th month of the 40th year, actually the only date in Deuteronomy, because it's describing a ceremony that took place at one time. A series of speeches given on a single particular occasion. Now see, if we don't support the scholarship that helps us understand when this was, who these were, what the context was here, the danger grows, folks, of losing the meaning in the text, and so losing the truth. Now, I'm not saying that, you know, you need a PhD to read your Bible. I'm not saying that you need me to read your Bible. But you need the support of scholarship, the support of doctors. Because there are parts of what you would call the very Word of God that over time have become all but inaccessible to us through losing the original context. The parts of the Minor Prophets, very difficult to get the meaning out of. So we're losing, scholarship is not at a high in certain ways right now. So if you're a college student here today and you're considering a major, don't discount a life of scholarship. You know, some of you parents are very concerned about guiding your children in their direction and their careers. I'll tell you, you want to guide your children in a career choice? There are other ways. But the life of a scholar of ancient history, of archaeology, is a tremendous way to serve God's purposes on earth. So it's a job. But I want to do it, and I want to go through it with you. And it could be fun. It could be exciting, actually, to learn. Because I want this book to open up to you. If you would read it along during this time, it can be very rewarding to you. So let's start at verse 5. What Moses is doing in this ceremony says he's not just giving the law or reiterating the law. Moses is interpreting the law. So he says he's expounding the law that was given on Mount Sinai for this generation. In fact, the English name of this book, Deuteronomy, actually comes from a mistake. It comes from the Greek translation made of the Hebrew scriptures in the 3rd century B.C. And Deuteronomy 17:18 has this word, Deuteronomion. Comes from the Greek, deuteros nomos, second law. And so it became called second law. But it's not really a second law. It's not a second law being given. But that's not actually such a bad name, because what's happening is you have 40 years later, after Sinai, they're about to enter the promised land, and there's a renewal that needs to go on. There's something that happens, a ceremony, in which the law is kind of brought up to date. It's reinterpreted for what they're about to do, for the new situation that they're going to be in. So the ceremony and the book that arose from it was written because God knew that these people needed to belong And these folks, you know, 40 years in the wilderness, needed to look both forwards and backwards to renew this covenant that had been made. Covenant of a previous generation for an entirely different way of life. So that's why when you read through this book and you make a comparison, you'll notice if you've been reading through, you'll say, hey, this sounds familiar. I've read this before if you're reading through Exodus. If you make a comparison with Exodus, you'll find that there are large sections of the laws and maxims from Exodus, especially Exodus 21 through 23, especially the Ten Commandments you see brought up again. There are these parallels. But at the same time, about 50% of the Exodus ordinances go unmentioned, unrepeated in Deuteronomy. What's going on? It's like a renewal of the covenant. Moses is saying, this is what's important now for you to know to enter this new phase. You got to look backwards, but at the same time, you got to look forwards. Do you see the differences? So the text mentions the Amorites. You know, and you read that, Amorites, it really means the inhabitants of Canaan. That's the way it's often used here. It's an example of a very generalized usage of the word. It means essentially west. And so what's happening? They're about to enter the land. He's talking about the Amorites, the people in the land there. So things were different. They had this covenant that was made that helped the people belong in the beginning back at Sinai, but now things were different. What's different? Well, first of all, they had a new leader. For many of the people there, Moses and the covenant must have seemed inseparable. They couldn't think of the covenant without Moses. But Moses had been forbidden from going further. He was about to die. He knew it. There had to be a change of human leadership. And Joshua needed to be leading and being followed in the same way Moses did, the same way Moses was. So there was a succession of human leadership happening here. And the succession was neither a power struggle nor a democratic process. It was a matter of divine appointment. And that was because the true leader of the covenant people was God. God himself. Moses and now Joshua was, their role was the role of a mediator of this covenant. Though they were effective leaders from the human point of view, the true leader was God, as they mediated his covenant with the people. Secondly, you had a new people. If you look in verse 2, you see these parentheses there. It's kind of awkward. The translators felt they had to put in parentheses because what is this? It's 11 days from Horeb to Kadesh Barnea. Why is that stuck in there? Well, that's an editorial decision. The parentheses were not in the original Hebrew. I would cross them out, actually. Because of this map here, it shows you. What's going on in verse 2? It says it's 11 days journey from Mount Horeb to Kadesh Barnea. People have walked that, and sure enough, it takes 11 days. Okay, why is this suddenly, you know, big introduction to the book, it takes 11 days? Well, you contrast that with verse 3. This is the 40th year since they've been at Sinai. Kadesh Barnea, right here, was sort of the entrance point of Canaan, of the land of promise. Okay? Any attempts at penetration into the land of promise started at Kadesh Barnea. And they came up around here this time, but it all started at Kadesh Barnea. So what's being said? You see, Moses recalls in verse 8, God saying, see, I've given you this land. It was 11 days from the entry point into the land that he was giving him. But the author seems to be pointing out that it was not 11 days from Sinai, verse 2, but 40 years from Sinai, verse 3, to this day of Moses addressing them on the edge of the land they were about to enter. In other words, this book is not about the first generation, but it's about the second. It's a whole new group of people here. That's why they needed a new covenant. There are different people involved in this story now. And Moses had, they go through a few victories that Moses had accomplished, preliminary, that had prepared them, gotten them ready. It would have been great if it were 11 days. It should have been 11 days. But things had happened, now it's a whole new group of people coming in. So, new leader, new people, number 3, it was a new geographical context. They were no longer going to be wandering around. They were going to be having their own land, the promised land was about to be entered and taken. Each clan is going to have its own territory. How would they stay centralized with this? How would they stay Israel? What would the various laws that governed their theocracy mean in this new region? Okay, so there was a tension of geography. And besides, the nature of law is such that it always must be adapted to meet changing needs. And if you try to obey a letter of a law, it could always neglect, it could lead to neglecting the spirit of the law or even disobeying it. And fourthly, they had new growth. Okay, now, if you compare the numbers, it seems to me, from when they left Egypt and where they are now, they're about the same. They have the same amount of people as when they left Egypt. They hadn't grown in the wilderness. But when they entered the land, which they're about to do, and they stopped dropping off in the desert, they were about to grow enormously. How would they remain Israel during that growth? So, new leader, new people, new context, new growth. Just so in the village church. Now, the reason I can do this is because Christ has named us as a local expression of God's worldwide covenant community, which he now calls the church. We're not the only expression in Greenwich Village, but we are an expression of a covenant community which God has here. So our church, it seems to be a very similar situation to these folks here in our little local way. Okay? The church is, as Mako mentioned, about some 8 years old. So it's not entirely new. If it were, I suppose I'd be preaching in Genesis right now. But it's not a seasoned church either, I would say. It's not beginning. It's entering a new phase. It's in need of recommitment to and recontextualization, if you will, of the original vision of the church. There's obviously a new pastor. God has graciously brought some new people to join us who are asking a question. What's this church about? What mean these stones? They're saying. We need to look at that. Look at the answer from that. Meanwhile, you know, there are Calebs among us who are experiencing a strange disorientation of church growth, always inevitable. And there's a new context. The church is entering a new phase. Many things are different now. We have geographical questions to ask. New circumstances, same covenant, newly applied to new circumstances. That's why I think we can learn from walking through Deuteronomy with the children of Israel, seeing what they heard, what wisdom God was giving them for this new situation. So God knew in his love for them that this new generation of Israelites needed a renewal of the covenant. He'd prepared them and refined them through various means, and now, this is in verses 6 through 8, he wants to give them this gift. The book of Deuteronomy is the literary record of these addresses that were spoken about that. And they, therefore, have valuable lessons for us to learn as a church. Now, there's one more thing I really want you to know about this book, because it's crucial for us to understand as the covenant people of God. And it's crucial for us to be able to belong, to fill up that sense of belonging that we have. And that is that this was a covenant treaty. You can start to see it even just in verse 8. That summons that he says, you know, this land that I have given you, it's a perfect used in contracts, that perfect tense there. And what we have here, during this time, in the 13th century, you had two great big powers, superpowers. One was the Hittite Empire up here, one was Egypt down here. And as usual, Israel is always caught in the middle of these superpowers back then, and they were fighting over this, and the Hittites were declining in power at that time, but they had a big cultural influence. I just want to point that out to you because of the form of the book that Deuteronomy takes. It was realized in the middle of the 1900s, this last century, that there were treaties that were formed whenever a king conquered. And they were Hittite treaties that were made. And many of these treaties were discovered. It dated back to the second millennium BC. They were called suzerain vassal treaties. Now, what's that? It's a lot of strange words there. Well, a suzerain would come, it would conquer a people, and a people would become his vassal. And then they would give a treaty, they would make a treaty, and it would be a unilateral treaty promising protection and belongingness and require loyalty from the vassals, the vassal state. And these vassal treaties had distinct parts. They strictly followed a sequence. The vassal treaty parts were, first there was a preamble, starting something that says, these are the words, da-da-da-da. After that, there was what they call a historical prologue, which means it was the antecedent history. It was all the events that led up to why this treaty was being made, how the conquering took place, and what formed the basis of this treaty. Then there were general stipulations, commandments that were given. That was the substance of this future relationship between the vassal and the suzerain, and the summarizing purpose of what would come next, which were specific stipulations. If this happens, do this. If that happens, do that. Then there were divine witnesses that were called to witness what was going on. And then there were blessings that were given and curses. Blessings for maintaining the treaty, curses for violating it. Okay, now where am I going with this? Folks, if you read through the book of Deuteronomy, guess what? Guess what? It follows that form. It follows exactly that form. Preambles, first five verses, you notice in verse 6, starts going through the history. That's our historical prologue. Followed by what? The Ten Commandments. These are general stipulations of this treaty. And so on and so forth. It was written down, it was put together after this ceremony, the book itself, probably soon after Moses died, took this form. And it was given this vassal treaty form. It's striking. What does it tell us? Well, besides the rather salient point that God used a secular cultural form to communicate the nature of his relationship to the Israelites, a point to which we'll return at another time, it means that God is saying that you cannot find the belongingness that you seek, you cannot find the relationship that you need with him, without being conquered by him. You know, these various renditions of the Exodus that we see today now that come out, they're usually pretty neat and usually incomplete. I'm thinking of this recent one by Disney, The Prince of Egypt, the animated film. What's the climax of that film? It's the crossing of the Red Sea. That's like the end of the story. The people have been set free. If you make that the climax of the story, you miss the point of the story. The point of the story was not that these people were being set free from this bondage just to be free. The point is that they were being conquered by God. They were being conquered and released from the worldly power which was holding them in bondage, Egypt. So they'd come out and worship God. They were there to be conquered by God. So this very form here that we had, a very legal literary genre in which we find this revelation, is sending us a message. Until you are conquered by God, the true suzerain, the good king, you cannot belong. You cannot fill up that belonging that you experience without letting God conquer you, without letting God contradict you, have his way over you. And folks, that's always a shock. This is not the way you feel like you need to get belonging. It's more violent than you feel. You want to be rescued, but you don't want to be conquered. The message here is that in order to be rescued, you need to be conquered. You can't be rescued until you're conquered. You have to let God be the suzerain in this treaty. And that's always a shock. That's always a shock when you realize God is not your consultant. And it's a shock for Christians, too. Even, you know, we should be good at being conquered, but always comes as a shock to us as well. It's a shock to have him say no in your life. It's, you know, you're not this politically autonomous entity. events in your life right now you're struggling against, some of you, you need to let him conquer you. You need to do that. As the Apostle Paul put it in 1 Corinthians 7. You know, he who was a slave when he was called becomes the Lord's freedman. He was a free man when he was called, is Christ's slave. And then he goes to say why. You were bought with a price. And so this is what we're going to conclude with as we come to the Lord's table. The one who conquers you is the one who rescues you. See in this picture here, this is actually Hammurabi's law code. And there's Hammurabi, there's a vassal. Okay, he's conquering, that's why he's sitting down. Right? And then this was his law. It's written here, you can't see it. Well, the difference here, folks, is that the one who has conquered you hasn't, before he sat down, he came to be one of you. He came to rescue you. Just as the Israelites passed through the Red Sea, we saw last week, went through that baptism with Moses. Moses was saving them and then turning around telling them that God has conquered you. Okay? What we have is someone better than Moses. And when Jesus stood there at the Last Supper and said these words, this is the blood of the new covenant. He was saying the master, the mediator, and the means of your coming to belong are one and the same. The one who has conquered you is the one who has also rescued you. He rescues you by taking upon your burdens, taking you out of bondage to the many, many, many things to which you are in bondage to. Letting him conquer you turns your longing into belonging. Let's come experience that now at the table. Would you stand with me? The Lord be with you. Lift up your hearts. Let us give thanks to the Lord our God. Oh, it is indeed right, and it is our greatest joy to give you thanks and praise. You are ruler, you are conqueror, because you have conquered us in such a way for us to know we can belong, not to bring us into another bondage, but to release us from bondage. And we're celebrating that today. We're celebrating you today as we come to this table. And because of that, we can join our voices with the endless choirs of angels, with the people who have been part of this program for so long, in their unending hymn of praise.